I Could Murder a Podcast is proudly part of the Acast Creator Network. For hundreds of extra minisodes and other content, along with our private Discord server and live Q&As, exclusive merch and much more, consider subscribing to icmap.co.uk.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to I Could Murder a Podcast. We are back once again and it's a pleasure to be with you guys. And I'm joined by, Jesus, I'm joined by the panicky, plodding, precarious, predatory, pessimistic, pervert, Ben Carter.
Started so well and then...
Panicky. Yeah.
Panicky's all right. I don't mind being a bit panicky. It means I'm sort of aware.
I don't know, just bad in a crisis.
Yeah, that's okay. But I mean, yeah, the rest of it's terrible. And I did not sign up on that. Not that I've signed up on any of the other ones, to be fair. But yeah, how are we doing, boys? It's great to be back with another episode. And I'm thrilled to be in your company, to be honest. The Cray Twins, wowza. I'm going to throw over to one of my gangsters, producer Dan Lambert.
It's a fucking shootout.
I can't do it. Tom does the best one.
I mean, I can't do it. That's the point. I'm terrible at it. But yes, it's been a season of bad impressions.
It has really been a season full of characters that you could play, Tom. Michael Peterson.
Yeah.
The Krays. Yeah. Who else did he do? There was someone else.
Casey Anthony.
there was one other one who was really good at. He did a really good Louis Walsh in a minisode the other day, which caught me well off guard.
Really?
Yeah.
I think it was just a camp Irish accent, but...
You were excellent today, but you did it.
That was pretty good.
Yeah.
You have the same kind of demeanour as Louis Walsh.
Not sure about that again. Didn't... sign off on that.
Predatory.
Nah. Yeah. Never.
But yes, we are back once again with a fresh new case. It's one that, a very, very famous case in the UK, and I think in pop culture, and I'm sure our listeners from over shores will have heard of these two, or at least seen images of them. It's one that we've been asked to do a number of times, but again, I think it still falls in the slight curveball category. And yeah, excited to go into it with you guys.
Definitely. They came up very briefly in our Charles Bronson episode, which was last series for the YouTube folks. It is still available on all good audio platforms. But I never really... I know of them and a little bit about them, but I didn't ever really know their full story. And my goodness, what a story it is for both of them, because they're twins. Yeah, just have some coffee.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe give your head a wobble. A big shout out to some people who did actually get the clue, the cryptic clue from last week. I saw some comments there. I saw a passive-aggressive reply from Ben on one of them.
Oh, really?
Well, Dan, you're the eighth person who got that so far.
yeah.
Don't know why you're angry at them for getting it, but
definitely. Part of it. Yeah, I mean, I did say that it was an easier one last week, and yeah, I think there's about 15 now that have received the sort of. I gave up on giving medals out because very quickly got through the medals. Yeah, well, I mean, sometimes guys, when the episodes go live now, we'll have guesses for the cryptic clues before we even wake up on the Monday morning. And a shout out to K Brody 97, who got the Cray Twin cryptic clue at 7:24 a.m. on a Monday. So I don't know. Are people skipping to the end of the ep? Because we don't want that.
I guess release at 4 a.m. for us.
Yeah,
it
does. Yeah.
Oh, perfect.
It's done that sport for about 8 series, isn't it?
Yeah, it has actually. Yeah.
New provider and everything. I just didn't. But yeah, loads of people got it right. It was, of course, Claw. Arnie and Danny have had a bit too much to drink. They're getting a bit cray, and they're twins, cray twins. Loads of people guessed the Ericsson twins. You know, that we did that Minnesota on the website a few years ago, Tom, the Swedish twins on the motorway.
Oh, yeah.
Loads of people were guessing that.
That guess, that kind of does make sense. That one, we covered that on the Minnesota, if you are interested in that case. A very fascinating case of the puff of smoke, the folie à deux. But yes, we're going all the way to the East End, Gangsterville. And very fascinating case.
So this week, it is, of course, the case of the Cray twins, also known as the case of Ronnie and Reggie Cray, Britain's most notorious criminals, the bad brothers of Bethnal Green, and the East End gangsters. It's a fascinating case. There's lots of twists and turns, as there has been throughout this series. But it's nice to finally do something a little bit different. And producer Dan is going to set the scene.
Ronnie and Reggie Cray, infamous criminal twin brothers from London's East End, exploded onto the scene in the swinging 1960s, rising to infamy as larger-than-life gangsters and underworld overlords. With a lethal cocktail of charm and extreme violence, the pair carved out their empire through a trail of blood, guts, and broken bones amidst numerous turf wars. Their criminal portfolio ranged from daring armed robberies to chilling contract killings, with multiple instances of arson and extortion, making the twins feared and revered in equal measure across London's seedy streets. But it wasn't just their criminal exploits that captured the public's imagination. It was their magnetic personalities and glamorous celebrity connections that added an irresistible and contrasting allure to their dark and dangerous world. The Crays lived fast, loved hard, and fought dirty, leaving behind a legacy of brutality and mayhem that continues to fascinate and terrify to this very day.
So yeah, it's an absolutely wild case. A lot of people refer to the Crays as folk heroes. Other people view them simply as brutish criminals. Very common pet names as well, Ronnie and Reggie. And I don't want to offend. I definitely know someone that's named either a couple of dogs, a couple of cats, a couple of fish, a couple of rats, Ronnie and Reggie. It's not coming to mind who you are. But very common pet names.
Brave calling the Crays rats, Ben, this early on into the episode.
They were not my words, of course.
Well, you just said it.
Yeah, it was the friend with the pets.
This friend. fair play to you, Ben. And as always, we like to use our resident voice, the voice he likes to call himself, which is a bit... In fact, his gamer tag is also the voice. We'd like to throw to the voice, Dan Lambert, for this quote.
In this world, you either rise to the top or you fall to the bottom. There's no in between. Me and my brother Ronnie are the rulers of this city, and no one can challenge that. There's no honour among thieves, but there is among brothers. We aren't ordinary people. We're the Crays. Maybe you've heard of us.
Chills.
Thank you.
Yeah, intimidation.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So, of course, we're going to take a look in detail at the lives and crimes of Ronnie and Reggie Cray to see exactly how they became Britain's most notorious criminals before moving on to the aftermath and looking at the legacy / infamy the pair left behind.
Ronald Ronnie and Reginald Reggie Cray were both born on the 24th of October 1933 in Haggerston, East London. The identical twins were the third and fourth children born to Charles David Cray and Violet Annie Lee, with Reggie being born just 10 minutes before Ronnie. The pair had an older brother, Charles Charlie James Cray, and they would also have had an older sister named Violet, presumably named after her mother, but she sadly passed away shortly after she was born. So yeah, before the Cray twins were born, the household would have been two Charles and two Violets. But obviously, sadly, Violet Jr. passed away.
I went to uni in Haggerston.
Did you actually?
Yeah, so watch out. There might be a twin brother about.
Which one are you, Dan? If you had to pick.
We'll find out.
Without any reference to what they did. Okay.
The Cray family considered themselves thoroughbred EastEnders, and they were very, very proud of this claim, with the twins' father Charles originally being from Shoreditch, whilst their mother, Violet, was originally from Bethnal Green. Though some are very quick to point out that the twins had an ancestry that included diverse European groups, including Romani, Austrian Jewish, and Irish. And yeah, this is something that the twins and many others have since disputed, but people always sort of say, oh, Romani and Irish is a very interesting mix. Quite early on in their lives, at just 3 years old, both twins suddenly became very ill and were diagnosed with diphtheria, which is a fairly serious and highly contagious bacterial infection that can impact the mouth, nose, and throat. And yeah, this infection can be, and was far more likely to be back in those days, fatal. Though Reggie recovered fairly quickly, Ronnie almost died from the infection, and apparently his condition was getting so bad and so rapidly deteriorating that his mother, Violet, eventually became doubtful of the doctor's abilities, and so she removed him from the hospital and he eventually recovered at home. But yeah, that's quite a bold move. The twins would also encounter a similar circumstance a few years later when they both caught measles. And yeah, apparently from this moment, this is the kind of the first element where you notice a real difference between the twins, and Ronnie starts to become a lot more reserved from this moment onwards from his recovery.
The difficulties did not end there. Growing up in the poverty-stricken East End during the interwar period, the Crays were exposed to a tough and gritty environment from a very early age. The borough they lived in was rife with unemployment and surrounded by gambling dens, brothels, and drinking clubs. A gambling den sounds quite nice, doesn't it?
It does sound really cool, but when the fun stops.
Stop. Or just keep putting money on like Ben does.
Yeah.
Only post the wins. That's the thing. Only post the wins.
He hadn't posted in a year.
Why is he at my door again? With his fucking hat out. Their father, who was once an amateur boxer known as Chisel Charlie, instilled in them a sense of discipline and toughness, whilst their mother provided a loving and nurturing environment at home, though some have speculated she absolutely spoiled the twins at every opportunity, potentially planting the seeds of malignant narcissism in her boys.
So yeah, with this this little borough, there's loads of photos of the street they lived on. Little one for you. Just a few streets down from their street was Hanbury Street, which is where Jack the Ripper claimed his second victim, Annie Chapman. It was a really bad place to live then, and it was still pretty bad then, you know, thereafter. But it's okay now. Though the boys were only born 10 minutes apart and were identical, it was not hard to distinguish who was who based off of their personalities and attitude. Reggie was very friendly and outgoing with numerous friends, whilst Ronnie had a slightly different temperament. Ronnie was somewhat of a shy, quiet loner who preferred the company of his pet dog and exploring the ruins of bombed buildings during World War II. Whereas Reggie was a lot more like to play in the streets with his friends and like to socialise and be around other people. Ronnie and Reggie's father Charles was said to have been fairly distant from the boys' lives during their childhood. He was very, very, very distant, with the pair gravitating very much towards their mother as a key influence in their lives. Charles worked as a trader and a wardrobe dealer, specialising in buying and selling used clothes all over London. So sort of a modern-day eBay or vintage seller. But other documentaries and articles paint him very much as a rag-and-bone man who predominantly dealt in scrap metal, but would also travel all over England in search of jewellery, old coins and antiques to trade. A family friend of the Crays, who affectionately referred to Charles as Charlie, had the following to say on the boy's father.
Charlie was a proper pesterer, a travelling trader who would go on the knocker roaming the country up and down to buy and sell silver, gold, clothing, and anything he could get his mitts on. He became known for it, all over. You would always see him with his old clothes bag and a pair of gold scales. He earned good money from it, and his family lived well above the standard of most others in Bethnal Green. But he spent a lot of his money as soon as he earned it, and he was a big gambling and drinking man. This all seemed to be more important to him than his boys. He spent more time in the boozer than at his home.
So yeah, as you'll see in this case, there are lots of different characters, and the Cray family themselves, extended family members, yeah, there's a lot of interesting personalities. But yeah, apparently their father very, very absent, and he would go on to become even more absent as the years went on.
As well as being absent from the family home, Charles Sr. would also go missing when he was called up for national service during World War II. After being conscripted in September of 1939, Charles very quickly deserted the British Army and went into hiding for the following 15 years, almost completely abandoning his family in the process. He would periodically visit his wife and three boys to check in on them, but ultimately lived his life on the run, travelling and training from town to town. The pair's mother, meanwhile, was an extremely positive influence on the boys, despite completely dominating the household. She raised the boys to be polite, self-sufficient, hard-working, and incredibly family-orientated, almost raising them with a pack-like mentality. Violet was also regarded as somewhat of a local celeb in Bethnal Green at the time due to the fact that she and her twin sons had survived childbirth at a time when the child mortality rate was very high amongst the British working class. Apparently, in almost all cases of twins being born in the area at the time, at least one of them would typically die.
Yeah, the word was celebrity for Violet. Very well known. Everyone sort of viewed her as like a little bit of a superhero in a way.
Be a boring comic. From this fondness in her local community, it's alleged that Violet developed a bit of an ego, but also further bonded her relationship in closeness with Ronnie and Reggie. Ronnie, who has been described as the slower and more socially awkward of the twins, would pretty much echo this when he said later in an interview that, "We had our mother and we had each other, so we never needed no one else."
So as I mentioned, there were lots of characters in the Cray family, and the two grandfathers on the maternal and paternal side are very much highlight this. So Ronnie and Reggie's mother wasn't the only celebrity in the family. The boy's maternal grandfather, who was Jimmy the Southpaw Cannonball Lee, was also very known in the community due to his former career as a bare-knuckle boxer, but he was also very well known as a music hall showman. Grandad Lee, as the boys knew him, would regularly perform at local music halls and pubs, despite being the only non-drinker in the family. And yeah, these one-man shows that he would put on, he would tap dance, he would sing folk songs, he would play different musical instruments, balance on bottlenecks, walk across broken glass, and also put out a white-hot fireplace poker on his tongue. So yeah, Jimmy could do it all. If you have a birthday coming up or just want to do a little gathering with your friends, Jimmy can sort of cater to all audiences. Truly a one-man show.
Balance on bottlenecks, is that like he would put his weight and like handstand on him holding them?
That's what I assumed, or it could be standing on... I assumed for the handstand, but either way, that would be very difficult. But then standing on balance bottles would also be incredibly risky and difficult.
I keep seeing, this is a complete tangent, but I keep seeing those things where the steps of crates and people walking up them.
Never ends well.
Painful. It's just when people get to the top and they have no chance.
They get quite high as well, don't they?
Yeah.
Seems to immediately get windy when they get to sort of the fourth or fifth step. Crate.
I don't know if it's wind. I think it's just the balance.
It gets wobbly, I think, yeah.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. I've seen them.
Seems to be an earthquake every time they reach the top of it. Why don't they move, guys? Oh,
classic ick map.
Classic ick map. Classic brain fart. Oh, it stinks.
Tom, can you send me that classic it map bit? Just a little clip.
No.
Please, please.
There you are.
I know you're going to slow it down.
Classic it map.
So on top of this, not wanting to be outshined in any way, their paternal grandfather, who was also named Jimmy, Mad Jimmy Cray, had quite the reputation of his own. So Mad Jimmy, who ran his own market stall during the day, was known locally as one of the most fearsome drinkers and bar fighters in town, and generally someone to avoid if you saw him in your local pub. The two grandfathers, the two Jimmys, would regularly get into arguments about their beliefs when it came to drinking and fighting, and they no doubt rubbed off on young Ronnie and Reggie. But yeah, there's lots of photos of them, particularly with Jimmy Lee, the Southpaw cannibal. Not cannibal, cannonball. There's lots of photos with them and their maternal grandfather, who they absolutely adored. But yeah, he looks like he could go. He looks like he could go, Tom and Dan.
The two Cray boys were believed to have begun boxing from as early as the age of five. Five is a young age for boxing. With their older brother also being an avid boxer who was keen to coach his younger brothers. Sibling rivalry no doubt spurred all of them on, though both the twins showed a natural flair for the sport. It was Ronnie who was said to have been the far more aggressive, far more unpredictable fighter of the two, whereas Reggie was quite calm, composed, disciplined and technical, whilst Ronnie was extremely bold and violent. I think he came out swinging, looking to fight anybody who so much as looked at him in the wrong way, whilst also being willing to win by any means necessary. These characteristics would echo far beyond their time in the ring. Yeah, it's funny how their boxing prowess and how they would go about the fights literally would kind of echo in the rest of their lives in terms of how they would behave in certain scenarios. One being very calculated and thinking things through, and the other one just coming in Their older brother Charles went on to carry out his national service in the Royal Navy, boxing as a welterweight whilst he was there, and had a very impressive record, winning the majority of his 100 plus fights. I don't know, it's pathetic to think, but I think the boxing gloves in those days were probably quite heavy, so I can just think of the damage done to the the brain then would not be fun to look at. All three of the Cray boys would go on to hold impressive amateur boxing careers, including three appearances at the finals of London School's Boxing Championship, with only his criminal record later preventing Reggie from going professional. The eldest brother Charles recalled the following.
As boxers, they were quite different from each other. Reggie was cool, cautious, with plenty of skill. Most importantly, he always listened to advice. Ronnie was quite the opposite. He would go in, boots and all, and never hold back until he dropped.
The boys attended Wood Close School in Brick Lane before going on to attend Daniel Street School in Bethnal Green and eventually Bridge Street Boys School in Hadley, all of which came with numerous antisocial and violent behaviours. Though Reggie was said to have excelled at English and maths, and Ronnie had a gift for general knowledge, the boys' time at each different school was marred by numerous disciplinary issues.
I feel like they had to give Ronnie something there. They didn't give him technically like a school subject, but had a gift for general knowledge.
Yeah. He was really good at lunch. Smashed out of the park. Every day he'd finish all his food, eat his crusts. Good lad. He's like the clubman award at the football team.
Yeah.
He doesn't turn up every week, but when he's here.
Ronnie was relentlessly teased about his eyebrows being too close together, which often resulted in fights, whilst Reggie found it incredibly difficult to socialise and make any new friends, whilst at the same time trying to protect his brother. Which again, him trying to protect his brother also resulted in fights. Reggie would get into fights, Ronnie would get into fights, they would also sometimes get into fights with each other whilst at school. Though, despite this, they would always have one another's backs. And despite their academic struggles, the twins remained fiercely loyal to each other, forming a tight-knit bond that would later define their criminal partnership. Billy Wilshire, a cousin of the Crays, said the following.
It's hard to say exactly what it was, but they weren't like other children. They were always together, never apart. Their mother just referred to them and called out to them as twins rather than their individual names. It seems like they were special, or that Violet had convinced them that they were.
So yeah, the Cray family dynamic was very interesting at this stage. Most of the males in the family were fighters, and the Cray twins themselves had obviously spent a lot of time being raised by their mother, who had essentially convinced them to believe that they were special or different. And they really took that literally. They viewed themselves as being completely different to everybody else. They had a special bond between one another. And Reggie would seemingly echo the statement put forward by his cousin, as he recalled in a later interview about his childhood.
From an early age, Ron and I took it for granted that whatever path we took, we'd end up being famous. We didn't know how it was going to happen, but we knew that it was going to happen.
What's that thing called when you put it out in the ether and it comes true?
Or manifestation.
Manifestation.
Yeah. Yes. So manifestation. So it's kind of what they're doing there, really. They always believed it. They always thought it was going to come true, and it came true.
After leaving school at the age of 15, both the Cray boys started working at Billingsgate Fish Market.
Crayfish!
where they would work for the following 6 months. And shockingly, this would be the longest consistent period of legitimate employment that the brothers would hold for the rest of their lives. So Reggie was trained up as a salesman for the company, whilst Ronnie worked as an empty boy. So an empty boy, essentially, I thought it was, from reading up on this, the same as a glass boy or a glass girl at a pub. Ronnie would be sent all over the fish market every day on the hunt for empty fish crates to return to his employer. And yeah, very easy for this to be span as like, you know, Reggie was more front of house than Ronnie type of thing. But other articles basically stated that these were literally the only two remaining jobs going at the fish market. Reggie would work most of the days of the week, whilst Ronnie would work part-time, supplementing the rest of his week by helping at his granddad's market store. Over the next 2 years, the Cray brothers' reputation for brushes with the law and involvement in petty crime began to emerge. By their mid-teens, they had already begun to establish themselves as local troublemakers, engaging in street fights and protection rackets. More often than not, this was the result of Ronnie feeling like someone had looked at him the wrong way, or that someone was making fun of him. The boys were arrested when they were 17 for allegedly assaulting a young boy to within an inch of his life. However, this case never went to trial, as the victim behind the attack ended up dropping all of the charges. Their criminal activities escalated as they entered adulthood, with Ronnie and Reggie becoming involved in organised crime and immersing themselves in the burgeoning London underworld scene.
In March of 1952, the Cray twins, who were 18 at this time and each holding aspirations to become professional boxers, were called up to complete their national service for the British Army. Perhaps in an attempt to mirror the father's behaviour before them, or perhaps due to the fact they considered themselves to be special or above the service, what happens next would go on to become a very regularly repeated anecdote for the Crays. After arriving at the depot for the Royal Fusiliers at the Tower of London, Ronnie and Reggie took a couple of minutes to take in their surroundings before making the decision that this wasn't for them. As the pair attempted to leave, they were stopped by the corporal in charge, who attempted to discipline them, but before he could finish his sentence, Ronnie hit him in the jaw and the man fell to the ground in front of a bewildered audience. The brothers then made their way back to the family home, but were arrested by police and returned to the army the following morning. Just 6 months later, and once again having deserted the army, Ronnie and Reggie encountered a police constable who was on the lookout for, by now, two heavy-set brunette identical twins who had gone AWOL from the military service. When the officer attempted to arrest the pair, he was physically assaulted to the point he was rendered unconscious, before the Crays were eventually overpowered by arriving officers and taken into police custody. They were then sent to prison at the Tower of London, where they infamously became one of the very final prisoners kept there, before they were sent to military prison in Somerset to await trial. Ultimately, the twins were convicted of grievous bodily harm for the assault of the police officer and then went to the Royal Military Depot Jail in Canterbury. Shout out to my friend Luke Webb, who works at the Pound in Canterbury, which is a converted prison cell into a bar.
Oh, that's cool.
That's cool.
You can sit in the prison cells and have a little table in there. And
do you know what the most popular drink is there?
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermès, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A nice cold pint of jail. No? Ale?
During the trial, it was suggested that the pair were to be dishonourably discharged from the army, and the behaviour only escalated once they learnt of this. Acting without any fear of consequence, the pair immediately looked for ways to incite riots or disrupt the authority of the depot jail they now found themselves in. Within a week of their arrival, they began to bully almost all of the guards at the prison, dominating the other prisoners who tried to intervene in the process. The pair emptied a canteen full of boiling water onto one guard. They threw a latrine full of communal feces at a sergeant that was passing by. They handcuffed one guard to their prison cell door with his own handcuffs before setting a nearby mattress on fire and placing it behind him. At any time they were reprimanded, they threw tantrums that ultimately made them more violent and unpredictable.
Yeah, that poor sergeant that was just passing by. It's very Bronson, isn't it? That behaviour.
Yeah, definitely.
Immediately taking over, immediately making a nuisance of themselves. And yeah, that is, yeah,
Dan, horrific. Would you rather a full bowling canteen thrown at you or a full big bucket of shit thrown at you?
I'd actually take the big load of shit over.
Yeah, but it's boiling as well.
It's boiling and shit, yeah.
Didn't hear that part.
Yeah, no, I said that.
Okay.
Boiling hot shit or?
Well, probably just if it's both boiling, just the boiling water.
But the shit you get like a million.
What's the benefit of the shit?
I'll go for the fire mattress put behind me.
That's Kings of Leon, mate.
For anyone who likes Kings of Leon, Oscar Corny is releasing a cover track of Pyro this Friday. If and I'm forgotten, then remember me for today. Just wait for the chorus. Sorry, carry on.
Well, when they were placed into these communal cells, they waited for a few hours before assaulting other prisoners, smashing a vase over the head of a guard, before escaping into the Canterbury countryside. The pair very quickly were recaptured, but not fully reprimanded for their actions. And they even spent their final night under military custody, drinking cider, eating crisps, and smoking cigars, having very quickly befriended other servicemen who had been assigned to guard them.
I don't want people to point this out, Ben, but I'm just going to say it could also be cigarellos.
I did. That's what Wikipedia said, but I Googled it and some people said cigars.
But we can put that out there. We're saying we're not 100%, it could be cigars or it could be cigarellos. I just don't want...
No, that's cool.
The heat we're going to get for it.
That is, yeah, real serious.
Can you educate me on cigarellos?
It's just it's a kind of cross between. It's like a mongrel.
A thin cigar?
Yeah.
You don't want to have a big fat cigar. You don't want to have a little cigarette. You want to meet somewhere in the middle. Have a cigarello. After this, Ronnie and Reggie were transferred to a mainstream civilian prison in order to serve the remainder of their sentences. When the pair were interviewed and examined by prison psychiatrists in order to kind of try and understand what the root cause might be for their aggressive behaviours, the psychiatrist who analysed Ronnie noted that he was, quote, educationally subnormal, psychopathic, schizophrenic, and insane. The pair were released in mid-1954, where they returned to the family home in Bethnal Green, 178 Valence Road. Their mother welcomed her boys back with open arms, but something seemed very different about them. After their experiences in the army, which actually was predominantly spent in military prisons, the pair began to approach their life in a far more militant manner. Ronnie began referring to himself as the Colonel and started calling the family home Fort Valence.
Kept just making fried chicken all the time as well, didn't he?
So much chicken for Ronnie. So, to this point, the Cray twins have earned a reputation as two of the more volatile and unpredictable individuals within London's criminal underworld and ganglands, whilst also regularly displaying patterns of clear disdain for authority. Any attempts to punish the pair for their actions only results in increased and excessively violent behaviours. And from here, things would only get much, much worse. And it is here that we move to the timeline of Britain's most notorious criminals, the Cray twins.
Late 1954, almost immediately after being released from prison and having realised that their once blossoming boxing careers have now been hindered by their newfound criminal reputation, now at age 20, Ronnie and Reggie decide that their last remaining option is to establish themselves as prominent figures in the London underworld. Deciding to enter into a world of protection rackets and organised crime, it is believed that this decision was heavily influenced by the pair meeting other like-minded individuals whilst being held in military prisons, but some speculate that their older brother Charles also talked them into it. It's interesting because obviously there's a lot of people you hear, even Anthony Joshua, saying that boxing saved his life. He didn't go into gangs and stuff like that because of boxing and because of the discipline you have to be a boxer. Would their lives, if they weren't shunned from the boxing scene because of it, which I think I'm quite surprised by that, because at the time as well, I know lots of other people in the crime underworld scene who were involved in boxing and things. I'm quite surprised that boxing shunned them in such a way. Would they go on to lead the lives they were, they'd go on to lead if they actually carried on boxing? Probably more than likely not.
Yeah, that's a totally fair point. And although we kind of painted initially their childhoods of having quite amateur experiences, they were held in very high regard. Like, I think Reggie had six semi-professional fights, or were they even professional fights, where he'd won all six, and Ronnie had six as well. He'd won four of them and only lost two. Gyms are usually, especially now as well. I remember, what's his name that does all the Bosh?
Oh, Tom Skinner.
Even Tom Skinner has like a little boxing gym, and he welcomes anyone there if they're to try and prevent knife crime. He says, if you've got a knife, bring it down, pop it in the box, and let's have a box.
Can I have it back? No, you can't. Stop burning matches in here, you can't. Ronnie and Reggie took a loan from their older brother in order to purchase an old rundown snooker hall and billiard club, which must be quite a loan, known as Regal Billiard Club, which was located in Mile End, East London. The Regal, which was originally a 702-seater cinema, was quickly and quietly converted by the Crays into a somewhat successful drinking club and snooker hall. It quickly became known as a hangout for men fresh out of prison, other gang members and ex-army veterans looking for any kind of opportunity. It also drew in a lot of attention from teenage boys looking for their first break in the criminal underworld.
You're not talking about breaking the old snooker table, are you? Or you know what I mean?
John Parrott was such a player.
If you rocked up to this Regal, you can be any of them that you want, ex-con, ex-army, a teenager looking for your first break. No one knew who you were. What would your sort of backstory be?
I'll tell the truth.
Okay. They'd probably respect that, do you reckon?
Yeah, I don't think lying's going to get you anywhere in this world, though.
I don't know. Some of the best crooks are the best liars.
What's your backstory?
My backstory, fresh out of prison for undisclosed offences. No. So shortly after the craze took over the Regal, a local Maltese gang soon became aware of their success and wanted in on the action. Numerous gang members visited Ronnie and Reggie and made varying attempts to shake them down in return for protection money. On the third visit, Ronnie decided enough was enough, and so he attacked multiple members of the gang with an alleged medieval cutlass sword. So I did a little search for a cutlass, and it's literally like, it sort of looks like Captain Hook's pirate sword. It's like one of those big, long, wide swords with like a curvy handle for the audio people.
If it was a guitar, it'd be an Ibanez ice pick.
Yeah, yeah. But,
yeah, Dad? Yeah.
God, the worst kind.
But the very jarring element of this is that who carries a fucking cutlass around with them? Well, Ronnie Cray apparently did. And yeah, this outrageous behaviour would very much set the tone for things to come. And perhaps unsurprisingly, the Maltese gang would never return to the Regal. From the Regal, Ronnie and Reggie quickly began to launch and manage a number of different protection rackets, whilst also organising and taking part in increasingly lucrative petty crimes. Whilst the brothers were also making fairly good money from the Regal, the hall was also quickly becoming a go-to place for other petty criminals to store their stolen goods and weapons. So basically, they would charge other criminals to store their goods within their facilities.
Quite the cloakroom, eh, Ben?
Oh yeah, have a peek in there and you'll be surprised.
Is it the Ninja Stars, love? Give me a token.
With the rise in popularity in not only the Regal, but the Cray twins themselves, they quickly became the main attraction of the club. Ronnie, who was very attracted to and inspired by stories that he'd read about the Mafia and Al Capone and kind of the organized crime scenes of Chicago and New York, quickly began slicking back his hair, wearing double-breasted and shoulder-padded suits, adorning his neck, wrists and fingers with heavy-set jewelry so that he could look just like the mobsters that he had been reading about. So at this point, although it's very early in their criminal enterprise, he was truly living his dream. Ronnie was indulging so much in this new mafioso image of his that he would even purposefully place a leather desk chair facing towards the entrance of the club so that he could watch people as they arrived. And he could finally see, this was his view of it, he could finally see people look at him with the respect he felt that he finally deserved. Bizarrely, Ronnie also demanded that everybody within the club... Sorry, I'm so giggly at this bit. Bizarrely, Ronnie also demanded that everybody within the club had to smoke multiple cigars or cigarillos, at different times of the day because he didn't feel like the club was smoky enough. Apparently, he would hand out cigarettes and cigars to punters and shout, "Come on, smoke up, smoke up. There's not enough bloody smoke in here." On top of this, Ronnie would regularly have his own personal barber drive to the club in order to receive a fresh trim and shave in front of his newfound friends and colleagues. He would also be approached by other people in the community who were asking for his help. Ronnie would occasionally get involved without asking any questions, even once preparing to burn a family friend over a stove without knowing the full context of the story. And we'll play a clip of this for you now.
Andy come home... And he said, "Len, Ronnie wants to see you up the club." I thought, well, I ain't done nothing to him, like, you know. And I was going in and out their house and that, like, as a friend. So I go up there, get a cab, black cab, and go up there. They show me in the kitchen, and Ronnie was standing with his back to the... I didn't know, but it was a gas stove. Then he told two fellas to get hold of me, and they got hold of me, like... And that's when I see the pokers on the gas. He said, "Now I'm going to burn your fucking eyes out." And as he's coming towards me, someone shouted out, "No, well, not that." And he just stopped. As he walked away too, I said, "You can go now."
So yeah, I think already at this early stage, the power has truly, and the image, the bravado has truly gone to Ronnie's head. Reggie, meanwhile, is trying to keep Ronnie in check, but also trying to run his business. But also... Reggie wasn't the complete clean slate that everyone kind of describes him as in comparison to his brother. He would also be getting up to some fairly shady actions.
As Ben said, it wasn't just Ronnie that's acting up in his new position of power and fame, and he certainly wasn't the only Cray looking to strike fear into the hearts of those who were looking at them enviously. For any kind of infraction or any time he was looking to send a message, Reggie had developed a tried and tested method he liked to call the Jawbreaker, which I'm going to surprise you here. It wasn't a little gobstopper, which gave him the ability to consistently break a man's jaw with one punch. Single punch to the jaw. He would offer his target a cigarette, and as it neared their mouth, Reggie would launch himself towards them. The open and now relaxed jaw would take full force of the impact, supposedly breaking it every time.
Oh, what a technique.
It's smart, isn't it? It's cowardly. Yeah. It's cowardly.
Yeah. Smart.
Efficient, though.
Crayfish.
Yes.
I would say. But I mean, it is at this time that Reggie and his brothers made the decision to form, in their view, the type of gang the likes of which London has never seen before. They carefully cultivated and selected different trusted acquaintances to join their group, which the pair dubbed The Firm. Eventually, this group was made up of at least 15 individuals, but believed to have numbered more than 40 at its peak. To include Ronnie, Reggie and their older brother Charlie, of the 15, two of them were right-hand men for each of Ronnie and Reggie, and an additional two were drivers for each of the twins. The remainder were made up of extended family members, bodyguards, former convicts and former boxers. The Crays, together with The Firm, continued to expand their criminal activities, including extortion, robbery and violence, to establish control over East London. And if we want to break it down, we've got some bloody names here. We're going to run through some of the names now. Albert Donahue, who was Reggie's right-hand man. Ian Barry, who was Ronnie's right-hand man. John Dixon, a.k.a. Scotch Jack, was Ronnie's driver. Maybe don't drink it if you're going to be the driver. Ronnie Bender, Reggie's driver. Maybe that was a bit of a power play from Reggie getting him. Ronnie Hart, the twins' distant cousin. Pat Connolly, a well-built bodyguard. Ben obviously liked him. Leslie Payne, the brains behind The Firm. Tommy Brown, also known as The Bear. Great series, I could recommend you watching it. Billy Donovan, brother-in-law of Albert Donahue. Dickie Morgan, a childhood friend of the twins. Connie Whitehead, an occasional driver. Freddie Foreman, a former jewel thief. Bill Exley, a former boxer.
A lot of Ronnies in that patch.
There is a lot of Ronnies.
Yeah, but only one Dickie. Meanwhile, Ronnie and Reggie's father, Charles Sr., was finally arrested after 15 years on the run for deserting the British Army. To be fair, the twins had barely seen him during this time as well. This news apparently had minimal impact on the twins and their older brother, as they had become so dependent on one another and their mother. Reggie had started to establish himself as a feared businessman, known for his sharp demeanour, and he would fall more and more into the habit of backing up Ronnie's dark and violent ways. Soon, the Crays found a new way of generating cash by, quote, poncing. Off other smaller gangs and local villains. So poncing, in the local slang of the time, was basically extorting a share of illegal profits resulting from thieving and robberies that the Crays allowed to be committed on their patch or on their turf. So they would let drug dealers, other criminals, they would let them commit their acts of crime on their, what they considered their neighbourhood, and then they would take a portion of that. Reggie would very rarely be seen dating local women and typically kept himself to himself, which made a lot of people intrigued by his more reserved nature. Ronnie, meanwhile, had no real interests in his life. He still lived at home with his mother, whom he adored, but he had started to develop, which was quite bold for the time, a very public and very passionate interest in other young men. Although he initially tried to keep it fairly secret, Ronnie did make a point of flaunting his relationships with men, which shocked a lot of onlookers at the time, as homosexuality was illegal in the UK until 1967. That said, he was very rarely challenged about it, but it was incredibly rare all the same amongst the mobster scene.
Autumn 1956, Ronnie, who had by now become even more violent, even more feared, and even more unpredictable, had already started to let the power get to his head. Anytime people were laughing or joking in the Regal, they would immediately stop doing so once they saw Ronnie coming in. Doesn't sound like a nice place to be, does it? Like, come to the bar, you have to smoke loads, you can't have fun.
Anytime you try and put your coat in the closet, it's full of bloody dynamite and throwing stars.
Just comes out ripped, you know. You got a problem with that? No. It looks a bit like all states, doesn't it? A bit distressed. In any instance that this didn't happen, he would more often than not assume that they were laughing at him for either his looks, his mannerisms, or his sexuality, and so he would violently assault them within the club.
Ronnie was regularly taking high doses of Stematil 3 times a day, which is used to treat nausea, vomiting and dizziness, but apparently this made him even more unpredictable and terrifying, so it was very kind of Jekyll and Hyde once he was to take it, though it would kind of, Jekyll was already a bit angry, but Hyde was very angry when he's taken it, even to those who knew him well. Author and historian Jonathan Rabin wrote the following on Ronnie.
He was savage and petulant and entirely full of rage. He built up so much rage for having to hide his sexuality, and he didn't know how to process it. He was a man whose grasp on reality was so slight and pathologically deranged that he was able to live out a crude, primarily coloured fiction, twisting the city into the shape of a bad thriller.
So this is where things start to now really spiral out of control. A car salesman in Bethnal Green that worked in a dealership that was actively paying for protection from the craze called Ronnie to explain that an irate customer was becoming very aggressive with him due to the dealership not refunding the gentleman for selling a car that burned oil every time he tried to start it and drive it. So I can understand the man's frustration there, but it sounds like he's not done his due diligence. The man threatened to return the following morning, and basically the car salesman called Ronnie and said, please, can you be here for when this guy arrives? The man returned to the dealership to be met by Ronnie, who by now had previously, he was very well known to have barged into numerous pubs and clubs in the area where he would behave very erratically. He'd also fired pistols within the premises of other pubs, so he was known to be a very loose cannon. Ronnie was immediately incredibly defensive and blaming the man rather than the car. The pair got into a heated argument before a physical brawl erupted, which only lasted a few moments before Ronnie pulled out his pistol and shot the man in the leg. On November 5th, Ronnie was sentenced to 18 months in Wandsworth Prison for his crimes, and his brother seemed to thrive whilst Ronnie was serving the time. So I heard quite a very clever little analogy. I thought it was very clever. I'll share it with you. Basically, they were saying that whilst the bull was away, Reggie would sell as much china as he could. Bull in a china shop.
In fact, it's really good. The more I think about it...
It's very good, isn't it? Very clever. I'm not taking the credit.
We shouldn't dismiss you so much, Ben, you know?
It wasn't his thing, but...
good point.
Dismiss him.
Dismissed.
Also, it's quite a nice analogy. Apparently, it was when the bull was away, they tried to sell as much china as possible, which I thought that just now. So...
sick, man.
It worked, didn't it?
Yeah.
Incredible.
The first year that Ronnie was locked up, Reggie sold so much china. The first year that Ronnie was locked up, Reggie opened a nightclub called The Double R with the help of his older brother, Charles. My family used to watch EastEnders when I was little, and there was a club called R&R.
Oh.
Which ended up as a nod to it.
Barbara Windsor link. That makes sense.
Maybe it was a little nod, who knows. The club would eventually become one of the more signature clubs of the craze and was immediately successful. More and more people would start to become aware of the craze and the different operations, and with Reggie being very keen to help his local community and numerous charities. The pair even started to form somewhat of a Robin Hood image. They made numerous £100 donations to charities at a time when a loaf of bread cost 5p and the average house cost £4,000.
Different times, man.
I wonder how much a Freddo bar cost then. Probably paid you to have it.
Yeah.
Oh, they've gone up in recent times. Yes. Everything fucking has. Why are you going on about a chocolate bar for kids? Meanwhile, in prison, Ronnie was struggling more and more with his mental health. On Christmas Day the following year, his aunt Rose, who the twins were especially close to, suddenly passed away. He suffered a complete mental breakdown upon hearing the news. In 1958, prison authorities transferred him to an asylum in Surrey, where doctors quickly diagnosed him with paranoid schizophrenia and put him on a routine cocktail of sedative drugs. When Reggie heard about this, he was furious, with the identical twins even achieving a very brief switcheroo whilst Reggie was visiting Ronnie.
It was a really basic, from what I understand. Ronnie was kind of in pajama type clothing, and Reggie walked in a big raincoat, and one of them nipped to the toilet, and the other one came back, and Reggie was sat there, and Ronnie was gone.
You could do a lot of sneaky things with twins.
Twin powers.
Yeah, GCSEs, you're better at science, I'm better at maths.
Yeah, general knowledge.
Eventually, maybe with some influence from Reggie, Ronnie was declared sane and transferred back to prison. Reggie would say the following about his brother being placed in an asylum.
What decided me to get run away from Long Grove, Nutdash and Epsom, was some of the stories he told me about the place. One day, he was sitting there, eating an apple, and this nutter come along and smacked him in the eye. As you can tell, just because he was eating an apple. He says, look, plate was full of nutters.
Upon his release in 1959, Ronnie no longer bore an identical resemblance to Reggie. It was clear that the time in prison and the asylum had taken its toll on Ronnie. He became a little bit larger in the face and body. He always looked exhausted, and he was perhaps even more prone to violent, unpredictable outbursts. Toby Von Judge, who was consigliere and friend of the Krays, made the following observations of the new, reformed Ronnie.
He was a very, very scary man. Believe me, I've met a lot of scary people. But Ronnie Cray was a very, very sick, psychopathic, schizophrenic, and manic depressant, all rolled into one. In one word from his mouth, he meant everything he said.
The remainder of the 1950s. During the next few years, the firm expanded their operations massively. They quickly became overbearing for other local gangs and were also able to network their way around different notorious mobsters across England. So yeah, they were feared, they were respected. A lot of other gangs were, you know, very disrupted by their presence. But also at the same time, Ronnie and Reggie's celebrity is continuing to grow here. Ronnie and Reggie became associates with a notorious gangster in Liverpool called Jay Murray, who would, in the future, have numerous fallings out with the manager of the Beatles over attempts to extort and provide protection to the group. Together with Jay, the firm began to engage in numerous acts of arson, armed robbery, and truck hijacking. And by doing this, the group became even more well-known, even more feared, and even more wealthy, attracting the attention of lots of new enemies along the way. The group were by now making more money than they had ever seen before, and this resulted in them acquiring numerous additional properties and clubs, in turn bringing in even more money. We move forward then to the 1960s, a very confrontational boss of a London-based landlord operation that was known for trying to exploit its numerous tenants, Peter Rackman, was serving time in prison, but still had people on the outside doing his bidding for him. Depending on who you believe, he attempted to extort the Krays, but it ended badly, ultimately resulting in Rackman selling popular London nightclub Esmeralda's Barn to Reggie. This high-end nightclub was used by the Krays to expand their criminal operation, but would also be used to attempt to bring the glitz and glamour of the West End to the East End. In total, the Krays would own around 30 clubs together, but this one was their crown jewel, ultimately attracting the interest of celebrities and high society. At the same time, the twins further cemented their status as underworld kingpins, cultivating relationships with numerous celebrities, politicians, and other high-ranking gangsters. They basically became the very rare combination of criminal celebrities in the process of doing this. In his later autobiography, My Story, Ronnie would recall the following.
They were the best years of our lives. They called them the swinging 60s. The Beatles and the Rolling Stones were the rulers of pop music. Carnaby Street ruled the fashion world, and me and my brother ruled London. We were fucking untouchable.
The Krays were photographed with dozens of very famous celebrities, including Frank Sinatra, Sammy Davis Jr., Bab Windsor, Barbara Windsor, Liza Minnelli, Cliff Richard, Shirley Bassey, Judy Garland, Joan Collins, Peter Garland, Dusty Springfield, and many, many more. That list, there's more to add to that list.
It's already a very long list.
Very long list.
It could have been like twice as long, man.
Barbara Windsor probably sticks out a little bit in that list of maybe being slightly low on the chain there.
Yeah, I was surprised by... I was surprised by Cliff. I was surprised by Cliff Richard.
Our surprised teacher by the Cliff Richard that was there. The Krays were even photographed by famous photographer David Bailey, who had taken iconic photos of the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. And these photos of the Krays would be printed all over the world.
So yeah, during this time, they're really immersing themselves in that celebrity life. They hired Judy Garland to sing a song for their mother. And it's also alleged that Barbara Windsor and Reggie had a brief fling. So maybe that R&R was a little nod in EastEnders.
The amount of actual like photo shoot-y photos and iconic photos there are of them, there's an awful lot. And a lot of cases we cover, obviously, they're very infamous, but yeah, they kind of seem to know that their brand was of such of the style and look and the power. They like to be known for it. They're very different to, you know, American gangsters who would try and go, you know, quietly. The Krays were very keen to be the public image.
Yeah, I remember in one documentary, the Krays referred to their own style as mob chic.
Yeah.
Mob chic, yeah.
That's probably fair. At the same time, Ronnie was becoming more and more comfortable with his sexuality, especially when he was in any of the Cray-owned clubs. Soon, he entered numerous short-lived relationships with high-society gay men, including businessmen, actors, and even politicians. There were huge headlines at the time and numerous articles that asserted that Ronnie had entered a relationship with Conservative MP Lord Robert John Graham Boothby. and that Boothby was a masochist who enjoyed being dominated by Ronnie. Ultimately, Boothby was given £40,000 compensation for the allegations, but Ronnie didn't receive a penny, furiously stating, "Proves what I always said, one law for the fucking rich and another for the poor." So at this stage, you could argue that Ronnie and Reggie were getting away with everything. You know, they were treading the line between, you know, criminal and celebrity, and people seemed to warm to them. But they would go on to make some big errors around this point. The twins arranged to travel to America in order to spend time and make connections with members of the mafia. This transatlantic relationship would give them insight on how to expand their operation and widen their net in terms of their different gambling and racketeering takings. News of this visit did not go down well with other UK-based gangs. Over the next few years, their criminal empire continues to thrive and grow, with Ronnie's violent outbursts and Reggie's calculated leadership driving their operations. Ronnie, absolutely not reformed, added to his bizarre collection of weaponry. He now had numerous rifles, shotguns, sawn-off shotguns, swords, daggers, catapults, several rare pistols, and crossbows.
Yeah, I feel like he's just collecting things from lost property at the Regal now. This is bizarre. And he's obviously got his, what are they bloody called?
Bendy sword,
yeah. Cutlass, yeah.
The twins and dozens of the members of the firm continue to engage in brutal turf wars with rival gangs, resulting in numerous shootings, stabbings, and murders all over London, ultimately attracting the attention of the incredibly feared torture gang, South London's Richardson Gang.
On the 9th of March 1966, George Cornell, a member of the Richardson Gang, was drinking at the Blind Beggar Pub in Whitechapel, London. And it's very important to note that this particular pub was on Cray territory. So there's quite a lot to unpack here about George. The night before, there'd actually been a shootout between the firm and the Richardson Gang in a nightclub in southeast London, which was called Mr. Smith's. Apparently there was a big fight on the dance floor. Don't play the song.
Murder on the dance floor.
There were shots fired, and eventually a member of the firm was hit by bullets and died in the chaos. Several members of the Richardson Gang were very quickly arrested, but George Cornell was not present at the shooting. And there's a very distinctive member of the Richardson Gang called Frank Fraser, or Mad Frankie Fraser. There's a documentary, I believe he sat down in his later years and did a very intimate interview. I feel like it was with Lad Bible or something like that, but I remember watching that a few years ago and thinking, how much of this is fact and how much of this is fiction, Frank? So this shootout had happened at the nightclub the night before, and the firm were incredibly unhappy. They were happy to scrap and fight, but not for one of their members to be killed. So news of George drinking in one of his local pubs very quickly reached Ronnie, who was actually out drinking in another nearby pub. Ronnie already had a bit of a vendetta against George and a very personal score to settle with him, as George had approached him in a pub on Christmas Day the previous year and called him a, quote, fat puff. Apparently this occurred after a bar fight between the firm and the Richardsons. Ronnie, perhaps understandably, never let this go. He arranged for his driver and assistant to pick him up, and then they drove to the Blind Beggar, entered the pub, walked right up to George, and Ronnie shot him in the head in front of almost a dozen witnesses. George died soon after. Ian Barry, Ronnie's assistant, who had entered the pub kind of expecting a bit of a brawl, a bit of a bar fight, was very shocked and confused by Ronnie's actions. And in a panic, George decided to fire 5 shots into the ceiling of the pub, explaining that everybody should not tell the police anything they had just seen. And bizarrely, that seemed to work. Police investigated the murder, but no witnesses were willing to testify, with the barmaid claiming that she was no good at remembering customers' faces, and other drinkers claiming that they didn't see or hear anything. And apparently there was one older gentleman who was sat in the corner that said, "I don't like the sight of blood, especially my own," sort of implying that he couldn't tell them anything. On these actions, Ronnie would recall in his later autobiography.
"In front of a table full of villains, George Cornell called me a fat puff. He virtually signed his own death warrant, and I felt fucking marvellous. I've never felt so good, so bloody alive, before or since. 20 years on, and I can recall every second of the killing of George Cornell. I've replayed it in my mind millions of times."
So this incident itself almost sparked an all-out gang war and also caused serious harm with the relationship between the firm and the American mafia, with members of the mafia referring to Ronnie as an idiot for doing this by himself and for doing this in public instead of arranging for someone else to do it for him in a far more discreet, accidental-looking manner. Despite numerous attempts from Reggie to reconcile this and convince the mafia that the firm was still their best bet for an international partnership, their relationship ended soon after this. And yeah, the brothers were always close, but I feel like this is the first time really Reggie is starting to look at Ronnie as somewhat of a burden. All was not bad though in Reggie's world, despite his growing disappointment with his brother. Reggie found love, or alleged love. He ended up marrying a girl that grew up in his neighbourhood. She was actually 10 years younger than him, and her name was Frances Shea. Although it's alleged that Reggie was actually far more interested in Frances's older brother, but that the brother had actually rejected Reggie. Their marriage was very turbulent, to say the least, and Frances' mother actually attended the wedding, or it's alleged that she attended the wedding wearing all black as a way of kind of protesting their relationship and their interloping.
I rate that. I think it's a nice passive aggressive, not too, it's like, yeah, I don't approve of this, look what I'm wearing, but also you can make yourself look nice while doing it. It's like a dirty protest, but a lot more sophisticated.
Yeah, a sophisticated dirty protest.
And less shit. Don't want shit on a wedding day.
No, not at all. So throughout all of their short-lived marriage, Ronnie became incredibly jealous of Frances, thinking that she was going to steal his brother away from him, whilst Reggie also allegedly became quite abusive of her. Frances would sleep with a gun under her pillow and begin a course of numerous different antidepressants.
12th of December 1966, despite initial reservations from Reggie, Ronnie convinced members of the firm to help break out a notorious British criminal, the Mad Axeman, Frank Mitchell, from Dartmoor Prison. Frankie was a huge man who, much like Ronnie, was struggling with different mental health conditions and feared for his violent outbursts. Reggie had apprehensions about helping Frank escape due to the attention and microscope that his freedom would place on the craze. The firm helped Frank escape and placed him into a safe house in London. Frank very quickly became very bored and very agitated. The craze continued to supply him with food, alcohol and women, but this did not cure Frank's urges to get out into the free world. Knowing that Frank being found by the police would possibly carry criminal charges to the craze, Reggie arranged for his murder. Freddie Foreman, a friend of the craze, claimed that he arrived at the safe house and shot Frank in the head before later burying his body at sea as a favour to the twins. Frank's body would never be found. It's also been alleged that Freddie was told he's been moved from one safe house to another, and then during that process they also killed him during the transportation. But yeah, either way, Frank's body has never been found. An additionally tragic note to make, shortly after this, Reggie's wife Frances allegedly ended her own life after being depressed and displaying suicidal tendencies for several months. Though her death has always been shrouded in suspicion, many people believe that either Ronnie or, even more shockingly, Violet, the Cray twins' mother, had murdered Frances and made it look like a suicide. Reggie was apparently never the same after learning of her death. Many are adamant that Ronnie would never have any involvement in this, simply for knowing the hurt it would have caused his twin.
Yeah, that part. There's lots of, in all the different documentaries I've watched, there's very conflicting opinions here, and they're very passionate about it. So there's one lady that was a hairdresser of Violet, but also a good friend of the family. She was adamant it was a suicide outright, had to be a suicide. There are lots of other male members of the gang that are convinced it was either Ronnie or Violet. But there's passionate opinions about this particular instance. So October of 1967, and this was just 4 months after the death of his wife, Reggie Cray was very much still in a state of mourning and depression. Apparently he would arrive at the club with stubble on his face. He was always clean shaven. And Ronnie saw this as a bit of an opportunity to kind of take advantage of his brother. Ronnie convinced Reggie to kill Jack the Hat McVitie. So Jack the Hat was an associate who had fallen out of favour with the firm, and basically they had arranged, or they'd at least arranged for a party where he would be in attendance, but Reggie and Ronnie got together and arranged, actually, this is going to be where we kill Jack. So there was a basement party in Stoke Newington, and the reason why Jack the Hat had fallen out of favour is that he was quite a minor member of the firm, but apparently he had failed to carry out a £1,000 hit in the order of the craze, and he had £500 of that hit paid to him in advance. So they were very unhappy with him. Other people alleged that he just hadn't found the right time and it was going to happen, but he's also been painted as someone that was very slow and steady and methodical. So as Jack, the hat, entered the basement party, he noticed Reggie was quietly sitting in a chair in the corner. And basically they had a little glance at each other, friendly smile, but Reggie apparently was just staring straight through him. Reggie then approached him before he started to scream a barrage of verbal abuse in his face. And he actually cut Jack the Hat just below his eye with a piece of broken glass. It is believed then that an argument broke out between the twins and Jack the Hat in front of the whole party. And as the argument got progressively more heated, Reggie then pointed a handgun at Jack the Hat's head, whilst he held him by the shirt. Reggie then pulled the trigger twice, but the gun failed to fire. As plan A didn't work, the craze quickly moved to plan B. Jack the Hat was then held in a bear hug by the twins' cousin, Ronnie Hart, and Reggie was then handed a carving knife by Ronnie. He then proceeded to ferociously stab Jack the Hat in the face and stomach more than 20 times, driving the blade into his neck whilst twisting the knife. Reggie would not even stop as Jack the Hat fell to the floor and slowly started dying. Partygoers looked on in disbelief. Reggie had committed a very public murder against someone who many members of the firm felt did not deserve to die, and this marked the beginning of the end for the Cray twins. Jack the Hat's body was wrapped in chicken wire the following morning and thrown into the sea.
Just picturing just a hat floating. And Jack the Hat's brother, Duncan McVitie, very upset with that. Biscuit joke. 8th of May 1968, Detective Chief Superintendent Leonard Nipper Reed of Scotland Yard had been patiently observing the Crays for the previous 2 years, looking for any opportunity to arrest them and bring what he considered their long-standing arrogance and obnoxious to justice. By this point, he had built up a mountain of evidence against the Crays, but just needed the final piece in order to tip things over for a guaranteed conviction. Eventually, Nipper Reed... keep thinking of Chopper Reed. Eventually, Nipper Reed made the decision to arrest as many members of the firm as he could and interview each of them separately in order to try and turn them against the Crays and obtain additional incriminating evidence. The Crays, as well as 15 other members of the firm, are arrested and charged with the murders of George Connell and Jack McVitie, among other offences. January to March of 1969, the trial of the Cray twins becomes one of the most high-profile criminal cases in British history, captivating the public and media, with many divided on whether or not the twins were innocent or guilty. After a three-month trial, Ronnie and Reggie were found guilty of murder and sentenced to life imprisonment with a recommended minimum term of 30 years. Their brother Charlie was also sentenced to 10 years in prison, though many people viewed him as far less involved than the twins. Both Crays said they would prefer to hang, given the choice. So the Crays, the firm, were very... against ratting out the Crays. They didn't turn against them until, you know, it took a lot of wearing them down until eventually they did kind of give evidence there. And a lot of people do believe that Charlie got an unnecessary sentence, a very harsh one, just because his last name was Cray.
Yeah. I mean, he was involved in helping them start their businesses, but in all the different articles I've read, he's very rarely at different scenes of actual crimes they were committing. So. Yeah. Yeah, definitely a sympathy figure in this case. But still, there was a lot of sympathy for the twins themselves because they'd given so much to charity and done so much for their communities. They were, despite some absolutely brutal, heinous crimes, they were still a lot of people that viewed them as like Robin Hood figures. But they were bad boys. So the 1970s through to the 1990s, the Crays served their sentences in various high-security prisons, with Ronnie's mental health deteriorating over the years. Despite being incarcerated, the twins continued to exert influence over the London underworld, with their associates maintaining control over their criminal empire. From prison, shockingly, the Cray twins are able to provide an 18-man security team to Frank Sinatra, who had visited England in order to watch Wimbledon. And this was via their... totally legitimate bodyguard business, Crayley Enterprises.
Prison guards did find a business card of the Cray twins whilst they were arrested, and they looked into it. But apparently, it wasn't actually like a really legit. They were playing things by the book and making good money, but they weren't doing anything that was technically illegal. But yeah, the Crayley name, obviously, very weak way of trying to hide what it is. But I guess that's part of it, wasn't it? Yeah. And obviously, Frank Sinatra also had his links to the mob in America as well.
Yeah. In August of 1982, the twins, under a huge police escort, were controversially allowed to attend their mother Violet's funeral. There are a huge number of photos of this, as press were obviously made aware of the passing, and they had surrounded the church and graveyard. So the boys, in order to avoid the publicity that had surrounded their mother's funeral, and as well perhaps an indication of their relationship with him, they did not ask for the same permissions to be granted in order for them to attend their father's funeral in March of 1983. So over the next few decades, Ronnie was placed in numerous different prisons and secure hospitals whilst serving his sentence. He also spent some time with Charles Bronson, and obviously we did a Charles Bronson episode last series. He had spent a lot of time with the Cray twins and described the pair as the two best guys he'd ever met. Ronnie was kept predominantly in his own cell, and he was denied any special privileges and eventually was certified insane. He spent the remainder of his life at Broadmoor Hospital. On the 17th of March 1995, Ronnie Cray died of a heart attack in Broadmoor Hospital at the age of 61. Reggie was allowed to attend his brother's funeral, but once again was accompanied by a huge police presence. And yeah, there are again a lot of photos of this. He was in handcuffs for most of the ceremony. And yeah, Ronnie's funeral became a huge public spectacle. The streets were lined with thousands of people. And he was almost given a hero's send-off, which is, yeah, it's kind of a jarring element of this case. Reggie Cray, meanwhile, spent most of his sentence in prisons in Maidstone and Norfolk. He passed away from cancer at the age of 66 in the year 2000. He had been released from prison earlier that year on compassionate grounds and was staying at a specialist hotel in Norfolk that was apparently, because he had now been declared bankrupt, it was apparently funded by an anonymous friend. Various celebrities sent wreaths and condolences upon hearing of his death, including Roger Daltrey, Barbara Windsor, and the Smiths singer Morrissey. The Crays were buried in Chingford Mount Cemetery, East London. Reggie gave a final deathbed confession of one more murder shortly before he passed away. And many people believe this to be Mad Teddy Smith, who has been described as, quote, a psychopathic homosexual who was rumoured to have had an affair with Ronnie Cray whilst he was married to Frances. So on Reggie passing away and now both of the Cray twins being dead, many different people had many different things to say about them. Some people mourned their passing, other people celebrated it. On Ronnie Cray dying, Toby Von Judge, who we mentioned earlier, did a quote earlier, a very close friend of the Crays, said the following.
He wasn't a colonel, he wasn't a boss, he wasn't a leader of men. He was a mass murderer. He enjoyed, like a serial killer, he enjoyed what he did. He got a kick out of it.
So the strangeness of this case is that it could have gone so many different ways. Lots of people were looking to kill them just before they were arrested, and some members of the firm were even turning against them after the murder of Jack the Hat. And also, they could probably have gotten away with their crimes for numerous more years, like we mentioned, if the power and fame and money hadn't gone to their heads, and also their public image and them liking being seen. Like we said about the American mob, they like to do things behind closed doors in a very subtle way, but the Crays seem to very much, like a moth to a flame, or just an LED light, very suckered towards it. With many people blaming Ronnie for manipulating Reggie's dark elements of his psyche. Freddie Foreman, a former member of the firm, had the following to say on the twins' death.
It would have been so much better if they had fucking ironed out the two twins earlier. It would have saved a lot of trouble, a lot of lives. A lot of people wouldn't have gone to prison. It would have saved 250 years of being dished out at a later date, and dozens of people would have been alive today.
So there you have it. That was the case of the Cray twins. A little bit of aftermath. Obviously, we've had to condense the trial and the time in prison slightly for this week's episode. The daughter of Charlie Cray, who was the older brother of the twins, Nancy, is one of the last surviving family members on one of the world's most renowned families. She's done numerous interviews with different newspapers and revealed quite a lot of intimate details about the inner workings of the family. But she was adamant that her father was far less involved than that of Ronnie and Reggie, which a lot of people tend to agree with.
Yeah.
In 2015, author John Pearson caused a lot of controversy with surviving family members of the Cray twins, as well as friends of the family and fans of the Crays, when he wrote in two of his books about the Crays and that the pair had engaged in a secret incestual relationship for several decades. He wrote the following.
They discovered they were both homosexual and were so concerned with keeping it a secret that they only had sex with each other.
Yeah, we should probably reiterate that is just an allegation. There's not a lot of concrete proof to this. It all stemmed from apparently one of Reggie's former cellmates basically selling this story of information about the brothers' very, very close, joint at the hip relationship. Allegedly. Allegedly joint, yeah, sorry, allegedly.
But yes, guys, a little treat for you here. So Ben's quiz went down so well, I thought I'm going to jump on this hype. And I've got a quiz very loosely based on this case, with the mention of Barbara Windsor. So the game is called Carry On or Carry Con. Or is also, ooh, matron, or ooh, fake one. Carry On or Carry Con. Dan, if you think you're going to go with, if you think it's a real film, you go Carry On. Or if you think it's bad, you say Carry Con.
Okay, cool.
Ben will say, ooh, matron, if he thinks it's real. And he'll say, ooh, fake one, if he thinks it's fake.
I'm going to write that down.
I'll do a little bit of a softball first.
I'll go first.
Carry On, range of femidoms.
Ooh, fake one.
Yes, there you go. Carry On, screaming.
Carry On.
He's correct. Carry On, follow that camel.
Ooh, matron.
Is correct.
Is it actually?
Yeah. Carry On caravanning.
Carry Con.
He got it. He bloody well got it.
Wow, that sounded way more.
Carry On, carrying on.
Ooh, matron.
No, that's a fake one.
Oh, shit. He's got me.
So it was just Dan left. You left this one, Dan. I haven't got loads of them, to be fair.
This to win. This to win, Dan.
Carry On, Dick.
Carry Con.
It's real.
Ah, fuck it.
Ben's back in the game. Ben's back in. Carry On, don't lose your head.
Ooh, matron.
I mean, yeah, he's in. He's eating a muffin during it,
scary
but he's in.
One. Sorry, I thought I was out. I thought I was out of the game.
Carry On, murder mysterying.
Carry On.
It's fake. So Ben to win.
I've won.
Have you won?
I think so.
Okay, this one to clinch it. Carry On round the bend.
Ooh, matron.
Yeah, he's got it there. He's got there. Let's, guys, let us know if you want to bring that game back another week. There's a lot of fucking films. Ones then Carry On Scuba Diving's fake. I thought Carry On Carrying On would get someone, but Carry On Screaming, Carry On Dick, Carry On Round the Bend, Carry On Follow That Camel, Carry On Don't Lose Your Head, all real. And all sound incredible. But yes, thank you for playing. Carry On or Carry Con.
Great stuff.
Speaking of loads of films, there are loads of films about the craze. The Craze, 1990, starred Spandau Ballet's Gary Kemp as Ronnie and Martin Kemp as Reggie. And then obviously the now quite infamous Legend, where Tom Hardy plays both characters, 2015. I still haven't seen either of those.
Legend's all right.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of praise for Mr. Hardy.
And that is the case of the Cray Twins. We hope you guys enjoyed it. We'll be back next week with a brand new case. And just want to say a big thank you for everyone who voted on the public vote. Obviously, we'll be covering that case next week. So you guys should have more idea than we do currently at this time what the case is. But either it's going to be, oh, that's a brilliant case. You picked a really good one. Or, guys, that one stinks. But we have to do it because you picked it. So, yeah, well done for just letting your voice be heard.
Yeah, absolutely. So on that note, as it is the audience vote, we do one every series. If you're not already, please follow us on social media at Could Murder a Pod, pretty much everywhere you like, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. We have a Facebook group, which I will kind of clutching at straws for something for them, but I've got a Kurt Murder casebook that I can scan into the group.
Definitely.
Tom critiqued my photos last time because...
I just said, you know, scan them extra mile.
I don't have a scanner.
No, we'll get on there, mate.
Okay, mate.
Get on the business.
Oh.
No, don't do that.
I can give you a printer. It's got a scanner on it.
I've got a printer. I just don't think it scans. But, you know, I'll pop some nice bits from here in the Facebook group. So please consider joining our Facebook group. But yeah, we do an audience vote every series. Next week, so there's no cryptid clue. Next week will be the audience vote case. So over to you guys. The power is in your hands. It could literally be anything. That's the scary thing.
It's already been picked.
Yeah, it could have been, though. They could, you know, if they get momentum on something that's not even really a crime, we'd have to cover it.
Remember before when the patron days when we didn't, people could pay a certain tier to then pick a case. Jack Dean, Jack mate, our friend, was going to do his parking ticket and pay for that, which would have been very boring. But anyway, thank you so much for joining us. We'll be back once again next week with your choice, so be sure to check that out. And don't forget to subscribe if you're watching us on YouTube, or follow us if you're listening to us on any of the audio platforms. And a cheeky little share always goes appreciated.
Absolutely. We are criminal resharers. So tag us in your story. We'll pop it straight up. We won't vet it. Straight up on the story. And if you can't wait until next week, we have got, at the time of recording, 150 minisodes over at icmap.co.uk. And taster tier over there. You can dip the toe, get half of the 150 episodes for just over £1 a month. Is it £1 a month? About that?
Cheap as chips.
Cheap as chips.
And you also get a cheeky little discount over on our merch store. So silly not
yes,
to.
Yes, get one of these bad boys.
Ooh, look at that.
Look at that.
Lovely little mug. And there's lovely new t-shirts, which we're going to be repping soon because I really want one of those. So be sure to check those out. But thank you so much. And until next time, like we always say.
Oh, we say this all the time.
Keep doing what you're doing.
That's it. So I've got two.
Go on.
It's the cigarette trick and throw in the latrine or... Don't do either of those. Throwing shit over people or breaking people's jaws.
Maybe it's a really solid shit and you do both at the same time. Anyway, thank you guys. To Pip. Till next time.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
I Could Murder a Podcast is proudly part of the Acast Creator Network. For hundreds of extra minisodes and other content, along with our private Discord server and live Q&As, exclusive merch and much more, consider subscribing to icmap.co.uk.